The Senate Committee on, Interim Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness will come to order. We were sort of waiting a little bit for Senator Olson. He's out doing business of the chamber, and he'll be here shortly, we do believe. We normally start out with the vice chair having some comments. We're going to overrule her today and skip that temporarily, the normal process. I'm saying that because you will note to my left, your right, thereby creating the mirror effect, we have a new senator. That's a military term that the senator and I both know. We have a new member of the committee, Senator Manning. We welcome you to the committee. But I wanted to point out we normally start with the chair making his comments and then the vice chair making his comments. And then, of course, when we had the presiding officer here, we would ask him out of politeness, hoping he would not speak. But that's okay. just to get a little humor in the thing there. But we welcome you. And I think before we start, I might even give you a minute or two, since most of us that are 4-4 have been here for almost 9 years now in the same committee and the same membership. So we'll give you a minute or two to introduce yourself.
Well, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, thank you very much. I am extremely honored to be here. I feel like I have been elevated to a subliminal level now where I am part of the knowledgeable group. So I intend to listen to you, and I know that you've been doing this for such a long time. Thank you for all your leadership. Thank you for your service that you've provided to this country and that you still continue to do for the state. So I'll be brief just to say that I'm honored to be here and looking forward to learning and working with you and get the business of the people done. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And just so everybody knows, the entire committee now is comprised of military veterans. Senator Manning failed to mention that he is a retired command sergeant major from the United States Army.
Pua.
So anyway, everybody on the committee. Pua, right. Yeah. Okay. Did you put him up to this, Mr. Director of CCBS? All right, come on. Colleagues, I mean, the agenda actually is really not very long. The first thing we're going to do is introduce legislative concepts. Then we're going to have three short informational meetings just to bring us up to date. And I'm going to open a work session on the introduction of committee legislative concepts and ask counsel to just give us a brief background.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have three concepts, as does every Senate committee. LC 178 relating to veterans can accommodate a number of things under that broad relating clause, but currently only contains language that enables hunting and fishing tags for disabled veterans. LC 179 relating to emergency planning, again, a nice broad relating clause that can accommodate a variety of subject matter, currently only contains language regarding the treatment of human remains that are disinterred in a natural disaster. And then the concurrent resolution, that is LC 180, it's blank to permit members who have constituents seeking road signs to honor their fallen loved ones, will seek amendments, and we have two pending currently. But there could be more. It could accommodate more.
Okay, Chair Goldquist. I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 178, dated January 8, 2018, LC 179, dated January 5, 2018, and LC 180, dated December 8, 2017.
Madam Vice Chair, Madam Vice Chair, Mona Sanderson has moved legislative concepts LC 178, 8 January 18, LC 179, 5 January 2018, LC 180, 8 December 2017 be introduced as committee bills. Is there discussion from members before I just do the typical down? First, I just want to make sure you put on the record so that everybody understands the introduction of a legislative concept does not, you know, equate to either support or opposition to a concept. This particular committee is a 4 committee, which means 2-2. And as these concepts go along, the other thing I need to point out, as counsel mentioned, is there are relating clauses. There is a series of events or a series of issues that are out there from a variety of members and a variety of the members of the public that will probably get folded into these relating clauses as they go forward. that discussion, the vice chair and I will kind of figure out what's going along in there. I would point out if there is an agency or a member that has an issue relating to veterans that is arisen or an issue arising from emergency planning, that they reach out to committee staff and the members so that we know what that is and we're able to integrate that. I also want to put on the record for the members of the public at ODVA that's out there that LC 180, the concurrent resolution for fallen soldiers, while the legislature did in fact authorize the implementation of signs and other things along state highways in cooperation with the Department of Transportation, ODOT, and the Oregon Transportation Commission, the fact remains the legislature has to direct them to do those by name. And in the short session, because we are limited to the number of bills, we consolidate those. And we do have multiple members who have constituents in their districts, fallen veterans in their districts, that want to have those signs placed along the highway. And so those will be, to accommodate that in the short session, consolidated from both chambers, the House and the Senate, into LC 180. Now, normally in a normal session, we have individual members and we sponsor individual bills. But because of the restrictions, we're not able to do that. So with that, is there further discussion? Is there opposition? Then so ordered. And with that, we're going to, and Senator Olson is excused on business of the Senate. We're going to close the work session with that. We're going to open the first informational meeting on the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. We're going to ask the former director, the now, I guess, interim new director of DCBS to come up and introduce his replacement, the new honorable director of ODVA. And I do want to point out, I think I'm missing this for the benefit of my good senator to my left, is we have the junior service, former junior service member, introducing someone from the former senior service member of the department versus of the Corps. So I'm just pointing out this is we're moving up in the world.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the acting director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the former director of ODVA. And with that whirlwind transition over this last month, wanted to make sure I came back both to make that warm handoff to Sharon coming in, but also just to have a great voice of thanks for all of your leadership and advocacy and that of your colleagues, both bipartisan and bicameral, all the success that we've had for veterans and their families. So a huge thank you to our team at ODVA, all of the partners that we connected with, all of you as the elected leaders and policymakers, and most importantly, our Oregon veterans and their families. We truly have made tremendous steps forward over these last 5 years to be better advocates for our veterans and their families. And we'll be very exciting to see where Sharon and the team and all of you in the community take it forward. As I dive into other committees like Senate Health with Senator Monitor Sanderson, or the House Business and Labor Committees on a host of range of issues with DCBS, none of my military jokes will ring true anymore.
<That's right. laughs>
So I had a number particularly focused on the Army. I was going to give a hard razzing both to Senator Boquist, our newest member, Senator Manning, and then also Senator Olson. But then I quickly realized that Senator Boquist is on Senate Rules Committee, and I will still need, as an acting director, his full support. So I am not gonna go there. And just one last time, as I think the first Marine to be the director of ODVA, I am taking my crayons and turning them into the Navy officer and the Navy chief. So that they can distribute them to any future Marines that join Team ODVA. But I will let Sharon take it from here. But again, just a huge thank you to everyone and looking forward to seeing where they take it.
And not quite so fast, Madam Director. I do want to, on behalf of the members of the committee and behalf of the entire Senate, thank the former director, now interim director of DCBS and former director of ODVA for his service at the Veterans Administration here in Oregon. And in addition to that, his service to the Marine Corps, service to the nation, and the fact of the matter, everything he says rings true in his tenure at ODVA, the strides not only in the veterans' impact in the veterans' community, but the efforts of he and his team under his leadership that have resulted in increases of veterans' benefits, which have affected areas such as the Oregon Health Plan, DHS, and services and other social services across the board. I mean, we have been on a march since 2005 to try and reach out and get more veterans benefits for individual veterans, which then help that individual veterans, but also help other Oregonians. So veterans who get on those benefit programs actually reach out and help other Oregonians. And that effort has been admirably continued from the previous director, Mr. Willis, to the last director who is now sitting before us. And I greatly appreciate the hard work that you've done there. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you. Really, I really enjoy working with you and your staff in your previous role, but really look forward, because I actually get more involved with DCBS. So I may be beating on your door a lot, but welcome. I'm so excited with the new staff, and I'm anxious to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We went through a lot of things in a short time, and I want to thank you very much for the leadership. You've been very responsive with anything that I've had. You took time to come over and sit down and help me understand a lot of the issues, and you know, you raised the bar pretty high because you put that personal touch in, and I think it's because of your strong commitments to veterans, even though you are Marine. I have a young brother that was a Marine, so they're not all that bad. I do understand the part about the crayon, and you know, and hopefully moving forward, they will probably let you take your crayons with you. Thank you, Cameron.
Thank you, Cameron.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Madam Director.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Boquist, Vice Chair, Madam Vice Chair, and Senator Manning. For the record, I'm Sharon Blasey, and I am the Acting Director at ODVA. I am a 14-year Navy veteran, so there's been lots of jokes back and forth. But before I tell you just a little bit about myself, I wanted to say thank you to Cameron. There are very few agencies that I would have left the Oregon Audits Division to come to, and ODVA is, you know, probably one of two, and it is such an honor. Senator Manning, you were saying what an honor it is to be in this room, and for me it is beyond an honor. As a Navy veteran and an advocate for veterans, this is just an amazing honor. So thank you for this opportunity. I left the Navy in 2000, and the VA decided that, you know, a degree in sociology probably wasn't going to get me a great job, so they sent me back to school, and I got a master's in public administration. And since that time, I worked for the Secretary of State for the Audits Division. I have sat in front of your committee before talking about the results of performance audits, but again, being able to come to the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is just an honor. I'm so impressed with the men and women that work at ODVA, their advocacy for veterans. It's just astonishing, the level of commitment. And, you know, we all know that there are many challenges facing veterans right now, but the work that I see being done, whether it's in the community, whether it's in this building, whether it's at ODVA, we know that we're making a difference every single day in the lives of veterans. So, but we also need to be fiscally responsible for the dollars that you're entrusting us with. You know, the voters passed Measure 96, and it is an incredible opportunity for us at ODVA to better serve Oregon's veterans. And I take that very seriously. And so I will always be open and transparent with you and, you know, share everything that we're doing to advocate for veterans. Again, this is an incredible honor, so thank you. And we are going to be giving an update. So this is the information that comes from our 2017 annual report to our Veterans Affairs Advisory Committee. And I would just like to start by saying, obviously, that 2017 was an impactful legislative year, due in large part to the voters passing Measure 96, as well as your work to ensure that the funds were distributed to great programs like the Veterans Services Grant and funds to help address homelessness for veterans. At ODVA, we continued to focus on our core mission of providing Oregon home loans, caring for our aging veterans, and providing other core veteran services, like ensuring timely claims and appeals were filed. We also focused efforts on some traditionally underserved populations, including tribal veterans, women veterans, LGBTQ veterans, and our incarcerated veterans. We expect 2018 to be a year of continued advocacy and strengthened partnerships. Thank you. So you've probably seen this slide before, but the information is a really great reminder of just how many veterans there are in Oregon, and that our veterans span four generations and five eras of service, including World War II, Korea, Vietnam, peacetime, and the Gulf War and post 9/11. As you can see, our largest percentage of Oregon veterans served in the Vietnam War. And our largest population of veterans are 65 years and older at 52% of all of our veterans. That percentage will increase as baby boomer veterans continue to join the 65 and older cohort and may reach as much as 70% by the year 2025. And on a side note that's not on the slide, but about 56% of all male Oregonians are veterans. And our women veteran population is also increasing. Nationally, we expect that women veterans will make up about 15% of our veteran population in the next several years. So in 2017, filing claims and appeals for veterans and their eligible spouses was the backbone of the work that we did for veterans. Getting our veterans into county veteran service offices and service organizations is very paramount to them receiving benefits. In 2017, there were almost 30,000 claims filed, which is an all-time record for us at ODVA. We saw an increase of 10% more county veteran service officers due to additional contributions from counties who saw the added incredible value of serving veterans locally. This is prior to the additional Measure 96 funds that we distributed later in the year, which we also expect to have significant impact across the state. Another highlight is that Polk County fully stood up its Veteran Service Office. This was after a year of training and working closely with our Salem's Claim Office. And in 2018, we're happy to announce that Marion County will also be standing up their Veteran Service Office, which means that we now, as of 2018, will have county Veteran Service Offices in all 36 counties. In 2017, we also conducted 415 appellate hearings for claims appeals at our Portland ODVA office. So based on the claims work done by our network of state, county, and national service organizations, Oregon veterans received an estimated of $1.4 billion per year in disability compensation and pension payments. This is 10% above the national average, which says a lot about the quality of work that we do here in Oregon. These payments are made to just over 75,000 veterans at an average payment of $15,000 a year. And we know that these payments are likely to be largely redistributed back into the local and state economy. 2017 was also a 20-year high for ODVA-funded home loans. We lent $73.4 million to Oregon veterans to purchase their homes, which equated to 278 home loans. ODVA's total home loan servicing portfolio is just over 1,800 loans, totaling $307 million. Our average home loan is about $264,000. As we'll talk about in our Roseburg Veterans Home presentation, we provide skilled nursing, memory care, and rehabilitative care to our two veterans' homes. The Dalles home opened in 1997 and has capacity for 151 residents, and our second veterans' home opened in Lebanon in 2014 and has the capacity for 154 residents. This is also a skilled nursing home, but care is provided in small house-like model resembling a home. In 2017, we cared for just over 500 residents in our homes, including veterans and their eligible spouses. We're very proud that our Lebanon home received the Excellence in Quality Award just 2 years after opening, and our home in the Dalles is also an award-winning home for veterans. So moving on to our budget highlights that you're obviously very familiar with, 2017-19 was a total of just over $26 million combined in lottery and general fund dollars. The amount reflected here does not include our other funds, which covers our home loans, our veterans home program, and also our capital construction. About one half of our lottery funds and general funds are passed through to the counties and our national service organizations. Approximately 10% of lottery funds were held in reserve for potential fluctuations in future lottery revenues. The other 43% of ODVA veteran services go to things such as our Salem Important Claims Office and our Aging Veteran Services, our Women LGBTQ Veteran Coordinators, our training team, which works with our county veteran service officers, and also our incarcerated veterans and our campus veteran coordinators in those programs. Okay. So listed here on this slide are some of the Measure 96 investments from last session, and I won't go through all of these, obviously, but I wanted to give you a status update on just a few of them, starting with the $4.5 million that is intended to enhance funding to our county VSO offices and the national service organizations. This amount actually doubled the funding to serve more veterans at the local level, increasing the number of claims filed and in turn bringing more federal dollars to the state of Oregon. Some of our counties intend to hire additional VSOs, and others will focus on additional outreach to veterans for things like leasing a four-wheel drive vehicle so that they can find veterans in very rural communities. Moving down to the $1.5 million to support veterans' housing and homeless prevention efforts, we're very excited to say that we've been working in very close partnership with Oregon Housing and Community Services on a proposal to really begin addressing housing stabilization and homelessness that affects so many of our veterans across the state. The governor has made it a priority, as you know, to end veterans' homelessness, and Oregon Housing and Community Services plans to hire a limited duration veteran integrator. And Oregon Housing and Community Service has also already distributed $350,000 additional veteran service funding to our local community action agencies through the Emergency Housing Fund. They also plan to fund community technical assistance pilot projects, which would allow us to create by-name lists to identify veterans and needed services. And then the remainder of that $1.5 million is intended to go towards permanent housing for homeless veterans. For the $1.2 million to establish a grant fund to support student veterans' success on campus, we're pleased to report that we've already awarded $1 million in grants, and we also hired a veterans campus coordinator at ODVA. These funds are going out to the schools as we speak. These campus grants are designed to help veterans successfully transition into higher education, be successful while attending college, and transition from college into the workplace and to the community. All 14 public universities and community colleges that applied received a grant based on their proposed project and their adherence to the grant requirements. There were some really innovative and thoughtful projects that we saw, like purchasing tutorial software for math and college writing skills, for veterans who maybe, you know, haven't written a college paper or taken a math class in several years. And also some other projects were for things like relocating the Veterans Campus Resource Center to a more visible spot on campus so that it's easier for veterans to find. And then next, the $550,000 for our Veteran Service Grant Program is designed to help fill service gaps in the areas of mental and physical health care for veterans, housing security, employment opportunities, education and training, and transportation. These grants will further support nonprofits and other community partners in their efforts to serve our veterans.
I have a question on
yes.
that.
Please jump in, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Regarding these community or these grants, will it, you mentioned three of the areas that were important, but what about those, I would say, I don't want to call them industries, but there are people out there that would like to do more research or more outreach to get more veterans in the rural areas. Correct. I mean, would they be able to apply for that grant also?
So Chair Boquist, members of the committee, there are certain eligibility requirements for organizations like nonprofits or community partners to apply. So they would need to be eligible. They would need to demonstrate that they have a past history of providing services, not necessarily to veterans. But the idea is to fill those service gaps. So if there is a need in the community that they're representing, you know, whether it be transportation or outreach to veterans, as long as the grant proposals demonstrate, you know, the intended outcomes, how they will benefit veterans in the community, we were given very clear direction that the expectation is that we will very carefully vet these proposals and the organizations to ensure that, you know, what they're proposing to provide, we have a good sense that they'll be able to provide those services, that these services will directly impact veterans. So we're going to be very carefully looking at these applications.
Follow-up. Yeah, I'm just thinking of a bill that came before us last session, and it was a nonprofit that's been working successfully in the state of Washington, and they wanted to reach out into Eastern Oregon in particular. Mm-hmm. And so I was just wondering if that particular nonprofit, as long as it meets criteria, would be able to apply.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I see Mitch nodding his head. I apologize. Mitch is our director of Veteran Services, statewide Veteran Services at ODVA, and so the answer to your question is yes, they would be eligible to apply again as long as they meet that criteria. Do you want to add anything to that? Please. That's a really good question.
For the record, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I'm Mitch Sparks. I'm the Director of Veterans Services for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And to answer your question a little bit with more detail is that in our grading criteria for the selection committee for the grant is that we have some grading that does give a little bit of weight towards our rural Oregon, Oregonians, and underserved veteran populations. So we were thinking the same thing, that there is a big need in rural Oregon.
Thank you.
Look, before you go there, let me follow up on Madam Vice Chair's line of questioning, or I guess one is a question and the second is guidance, Madam Director. We knew going into this, and we envisioned going into this, that there were certain areas that we knew, without doing a lot of details, and Mitch and your colleagues all know this, and the members, and I think even the good senator to my left, Senator Manning, is aware that we knew there are certain areas that positively work. We knew there were other areas in which that we have really good plans and ideas of what might work. And then we know that there's some of them that we're going to try and might not work. Your list here, I just want to point out that the guidance and the intent and the voters expected that some of these things that we're doing would be grand successes, and some might not work. And those that might not work or don't pan out don't become new programs. That's the reason we're calling this a grant program. And so when you evaluate these and find out that something's not working as well as another one might work, that, you know, just like in the military, we need to redirect our offensive dollars to areas that we're able to do that in. And so if some of these don't look like they're going to be as successful as we think they have, and of course we do the helping hand up and we try to make them successful, but they're not intended to be programs into forever if they don't work, because we need to reach out and help veterans. That's the first guidance part. The second part I have is sort of a question that's a follow-up to Madam Vice Chair's, you know, line of questioning, and that is that all prudent says that, you know, we need to hold reserve funds. And the nice thing about certain funds is we can hold those reserve funds for longer points of time. My assumption is, this is your question for you two, is as Senator Moss Anderson pointed out, as we go forward, I'm just looking at the bottom, $2.3 million in reserve funds. As we start transitioning into another biennium and we have these other funds, reserve funds, that are sitting there, that now as they are replenished by fruition for those of in the revenue who are following lottery dollars, that these funds start to build. And of course, those are funds that can be put into the grant program and address new programs that we're all talking about. Am I missing something, or is that sort of the intent here?
Chair Boquist, no, that you're absolutely right. But in addition to that, to your point about making sure that programs that aren't working, that we don't continue to fund. Part of what we do, and we do very well at ODVA, is we monitor expenditures, we monitor programs. We are incredibly invested in making sure that these programs work and that we're serving veterans. And part of this particular grant that you're referring to, the Veteran Services Grant, our plan is to actually go out and put eyes on some of these programs. One, so we get a better sense of whether they're working. Two, to identify best practices. What works well? Take for example, maybe an innovative or just a transportation program for veterans in rural communities. How can we replicate those? It would be really hard for us to come back to you next year or this year and say, we would like you to fund a transportation program that looks like this, if we don't have data and information about what's working and what's not working. So that really is going to be part of what we're doing with this grant program, is we see this as an incredible opportunity to identify programs that we think that will work, or that maybe we can replicate, or that we can apply across, different parts of the state. So I absolutely appreciate your comment about making sure that we're identifying programs that aren't working, so thank you.
And I would just kind of close that loop with, I mean, there are members sitting at the dais here in both parties, and that we're not overly happy with the executive branch budgeteers, not your agency, and not the governor, I'm not beating up, and in reviewing that, an immense amount of discussion and political capital was expended to ensure that the governor had support and agreeing with the legislature that we're putting all of this money into veterans. And I don't want to be down the road 2 years or 4 years, though I might not be here, and have somebody look back and say, well, we're taking this money away from the veterans because that program didn't work. That's why it is really upon your agency to be the eyes and the ears for the executive branch, for the legislative branch, and for all 310,000 veterans, and making sure we wisely do this, because there are certainly other areas, and those who know the budgeting game, who will be very, if a program fails and it's even $500,000 and we don't say, hey, we've recognized this and now we're going to reappropriate this money to go to X or some new program, a good example is the one that Senator Moss Anderson raised, then it doesn't leave us in a position to argue the case. You can't take money from this pot and put it in that pot. And there is going to be, unfortunately, that will be out there, because the fact remains at one point we had 333,000 veterans and now we're down to 310,000 veterans. And the reason being is they are aging like some of us up here, and they are passing away sometimes in the dark of the night and sometimes a little bit louder. And so, but it doesn't mean the state does not have that commitment. So I just encourage you, if there are issues, raise it to us so we know in advance. And please go on, Madam Director.
Thank you. Again, Chair Boquist, I really appreciate that comment. And my background as, a performance auditor for many, many years, focusing on you know, fiscal accountability of our scarce resources and really focusing on what works, what are the outcomes, how are we achieving our mission. That is a lens that I bring, and so again, I very much appreciate that comment. Okay, so just real quick on that, grant proposal is open right now, and we'll be closing February 1st, and then we'll be going through the process of, you know, scoring and evaluating and awarding, and we'll be able to come back to you in the short session and tell you about, you know, all of the projects that we – yes.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said that the grant, so the submission, the application will be closed. How was that put out so that other organizations or agencies may know that this even exists? I remember when I was speaking with the previous director, they were going through a rules process to try to determine how things were going to be going. I wasn't aware that it was out there for agencies to present an application. For example, I have a in my district, well, not in my district, but in my county, there is a program called Veterans Legacy. It's started by veterans and it's run by veterans, and the purpose of the program is to bring veterans in that are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, other areas, things. And what they have done is that they have acquired a previously owned county work form, and they've converted it over so that the veterans can go out there, they can get the help in a particular setting where they can, and they have a local psychiatrist who is volunteering his time to be a part of that. I had mentioned to them about this because I think it's a great start. It's going to be targeting strictly for veterans, so it's run for veterans. And I'm not sure that they were aware of application process being open.
So, Chair Boquist, Senator Manning, members of the committee, thank you for that comment. When we released this grant to the public, there were some things that we did. So we, you know, we posted on ORPIN. We sent out emails. We notified all of our community partners. So every email address that we have access to, we did send this out. We asked that our community partners send it to their partners as well. Again, part of this is, for us, this is new. And so we're working, you know, internally with our communications team to figure out how to best to advertise, to get this information out there. Especially in this case, you know, with our college campus grants, that was easy. We knew exactly who they were. At this point, we are relying, I would say, on others to help us get this word out. I know we sent out an email blast to legislators, and we asked that you please share this.
I sent it out.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. But that is, you know, you raise a really good point. This is something relatively new for us, and I think one of the benefits of this is we are going to be able to identify more and more who our other partners are that we may not have known who they were. So, you know, we've been talking internally with our communications team about how do we collect this information about who all of these folks are. But I would say at this point, and I will absolutely, we will get in contact with you, find out who, you know, all the organizations that you would like us to send this to, we would be more than happy to do that. But we are in kind of a development phase where we're trying to figure out who all these organizations are and to encourage others. Maybe they haven't previously served veterans, but yet they're providing a service, and maybe they could expand that service to veterans through this opportunity. So, again, thank you for that comment, and we'll be in contact to get the information.
Thank you.
It's gone. Okay.
Thank you. The last one that I'll briefly mention is the $245,000 funds to start a veterans volunteer program at ODVA. We just hired a very talented veterans volunteer coordinator that's going to help us set up this program and then start to recruit and train volunteers to help our veterans. And we're actually planning to start with our aging veteran population. Okay, so here on the slide regarding additional legislative investment for veterans, I'd just like to highlight one of these. It's the $2.5 million investment to Oregon Health Authority to improve veterans' access to behavioral health resources. This is a significant investment to better understand behavioral health issues that veterans face and an additional investment into coordinated efforts to best treat behavioral health issues. As with Oregon Housing and Community Services. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there outcomes? I mean, we can give money to OHA, and I want to see how many veterans have they reached out? How many are using the services, et cetera? Were those kind of requirements in this transfer of money to them?
Chair Boquist, Madam Vice Chair, and members of the committee, again, I appreciate that comment. You know, we're focused on actual services and outcomes and number of veterans impacted by this. So the agreement that we have right now with OHA on how best to use this funding. The first is they intend with our support, one is to fund a study of veterans' behavioral health issues, very similar to what we did with women veterans a couple years ago. So we need to know what the scope of challenges are, where the service gaps are across the state, how and make recommendations out of this study about how best to treat veterans, whether they're suffering from PTSD or traumatic brain injury. We need to have a better understanding of what the needs are across the state. We need a baseline to begin to best use the dollars that we're going to be given. I would say, quite frankly, until we know where those gaps in services are and what the needs are, it's really hard for us to move forward in helping provide those services. But the other thing that we're very pleased about this investment is OHA has agreed to hire a veterans behavioral health navigator, kind of like with Oregon Housing and Community Services, although I believe they refer to it as the liaison. That liaison is going to work very closely with us, with the federal VA, and with the other partners to begin identifying, where the needs are and work in a very coordinated and collaborative process about how to best provide the services. So that is another piece that we've agreed on. We still have for this, we have some time and some additional dollars that haven't been committed yet. And again, going back to the study that that they intend to contract out for is identifying those gaps and then being able to make some very informed decisions about how to use those dollars.
Are you sure you want to do this?
Yeah, because $2.5 million for a study is a lot of money, and hopefully that means it's going to be a really great source of data for us. And is this 1 year or 2 years, or is it a five-year project?
Chair Boquist, Madam Vice Chair, and members of the committee, for clarification, the 2.5 isn't intended to just fund the study. This is the dollars that we have over the next biennium to work with. That 2.5 will include the Veterans Behavioral Health Liaison. It will include the study, and then The information that we glean from the study is going to help direct how to use the remainder of the dollars. We expect this study to cost, you know, no more than probably $150,000 at the most. We were able to fund a similar study again that was very, very comprehensive with regards to women veterans issues, and that one was paid for, I believe it was under $100,000. So this is just a fraction of the dollars, but we really want to best inform and be able to leverage that $2.5
million. Thank you.
So I will follow up. Save my colleagues here. Can you give us, and if you don't have now, well, let me reframe this. We're most interested in the study. And we're most interested in hearing by this, about the details of the study and what their timeline is, what they're going to study, and when they expect to have results. And I would anticipate an invitation to you and someone from OHA somewhere around February 15th to explain it. I don't think your predecessor would dispute what I'm about to say. We have zero faith in the efficiency of OHA in this particular arena. This committee supported a large chunk of change two sessions ago to do exactly what we're supposedly studying now over on the OHA side. And some of us got in, I will just say, less than polite political trouble for supporting a wide range of increases that were supposed to help address this. And this is not an ODVA problem, this is an OHA problem. And so if we have funds to take action, but we're going to study it instead of take action, I mean, I think it's critical to find out what's going on. This was a very sore topic at the end of the last session. I mean, every one of us, the good senator from Lane County, is inundated with problems. I had people in my office this week on the eastern side that are doing this. I know for a fact that despite the federal government not liking to talk to us, that the federal VA, which, as you know, is sort of a different entity out of Boise than Portland, is actively looking for solutions. And so this is rather critical. I mean, 22 veterans a day.
Right.
22
Absolutely.
Veterans a day. Now, there's a bloody problem. OHA knows there's a problem, and frankly, a lot, I won't go much further. The OHA is quite aware, and I'm quite aware of some of the reasons why they haven't taken action. So if we're going to study it and we're going to get the data, it needs to be done awful fast. And so I'd really like by the middle of February for, if you want to punt, and I have to invite Mr. Allen and crew to come over here, I'll be happy to do that and explain to this committee what is it you're studying, how fast you're going to do it. There's a lot of data out there.
Right.
Really, the study is more of a correlation of existing data, because most of us up here are very familiar with this. You need to put it together, and we need to see what your action plan is when the study goes on. I realize it's not your agency. I'm just telling you that's probably the sorest topic in this committee in the legislature right now. But please proceed, Madam Director.
Okay. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, again, I appreciate that those very frank comments and your expectations of us. And I will tell you, we have the same expectations of OHA, and we appreciate that we have been allowed or been able to work very closely with them on identifying how best to use these dollars. And again, we do believe that a study is needed, will be very informative. In the last meeting that we had, we narrowed down some of the scope of a study and the focus, and they've been very receptive to our input into what we feel needs to be studied, and we absolutely understand the timeline. The plan is that we hope to go out with the RFP for this. You know, there's not a lot of entities that would be qualified, is my understanding, but to go out very, very soon. But we want to make sure that the study targets what we need it to target. And again, we have been very, very involved with this, and will continue to be very involved. So thank you. Okay, and the very last slide, I'm not going to go into this. This is just a recap of the legislation that covered some of the things that we just talked about. There were also some bills in here for just some cleanup bills. So that is the end of our presentation with regards to our annual report to our Veterans Affairs Advisory Committee. And I would ask if there are any additional questions at this point.
Colleague? Roseburg.
Okay, and I am going to ask just very quickly for our aging veterans director to come up in case there are questions that I am not able to answer. So thank you. And
Mr. Chair, just one brief comment. I mean this, you know, really jokingly, but the word aging, and it seems like I'm drawing a lot of people looking at me, you know, so I'm not quite sure what that's about, you know.
I'm the senior member here.
Okay.
My members, let's not compete for the bottom.
Thank you. So, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I do appreciate that. I know that there's been a lot of discussion over the years about what is the appropriate term, and as I'm reminded frequently, is that we're all aging, so technically we're all aging veterans, but I think in this context it does refer to veterans 65 and older, so...
you didn't help out here. Can I just point it out? You just dug a hole, Madam Director.
Well, then maybe we'll skip the first slide that reminds us of how many of our veterans are aging. The one thing I want to point on this, though, point out, is the last bullet point that in the Roseburg area and with a 2-hour driving distance, there are 49,000 veterans who are ages 65 and older. So that puts this into a little bit more context about the population. Okay, so so the way that I'm approaching this is a little bit of background information on the population, our some information on the two homes that we currently operate and own, and then some of the legislative background leading up to this, and some a little bit of discussion about funding for both construction and operations and the challenges associated with those. And then lastly, some of the questions that we still have outstanding that we need to address. So just very quickly, we mentioned this before, our two veterans homes that we currently operate, located in the Dalles and in Lebanon. But I did want to mention some of the benefits of to veterans that are living in our homes. And the benefits to their families. These are places where veterans feel comfortable and have a sense of camaraderie and live with those who maybe they served during a certain time period, including their wartime service. The care provided in our homes is specific to the unique needs of veterans. For example, amputation care is provided. And our skilled nursing homes also qualify for the federal VA daily per diem rates, which does help keep the fees and the charges to our residents at a relatively low cost. And then qualified veterans also have access to disability pension benefits to assist with care, but that would be true for our veterans in any care setting. Okay, so moving on to just a very high-level recap, the timeline of the legislation regarding our Roseburg home. And as you know, in 2011, ODVA was authorized to establish a third veterans home in Roseburg, and the legislation was specific to the Roseburg area. The 2011 legislature also directed ODVA to contract for a study of current and future needs across Oregon for additional skilled nursing care. And again, the study was very specific to the needs of skilled nursing. The report found that there are strong statewide and national trends away from providing care in traditional nursing home facilities, and usage rates for our non-veteran nursing homes in Oregon is quite low at 60% average occupancy rate. The study also found that most veterans needing nursing care are receiving care in non-USDVA supported sites, and significant shifts in these proportions aren't likely to change. Regarding the workforce capacity, In rural areas, the study noted that rural areas have a greater challenge in hiring and retaining licensed and non-licensed staffing. And then the study also noted that if a third Oregon Veterans home is built, careful reconsideration should be given to siting the home in Roseburg. But I want to point out the study, again, was very specific to nursing care. So they were focused on whether or not there is a need in the Roseburg area for nursing care. Okay. So I believe as a result of some of those findings, last year, ODVA received direction from the legislature to convene a rural medical training facilities work group and look at issues related to alleviating the shortage of nurses and medical technicians in the Roseburg area and Douglas County. That group has met three times since convened, and I was able to attend the third meeting earlier this week and hear presentations on some of the reasons for the shortages of nurses and the grave concern that the shortage will continue as more nurses continue to retire. One of the reasons cited, obviously, is the low pay for staff at state medical schools being a barrier to being able to retain staff at medical schools, not just in rural areas, but across the state of Oregon. And then the other piece of information that was provided was that oftentimes the desire to work in the larger hospitals in larger communities for those that are graduating from medical school is oftentimes a barrier because they may not stay in the area that they were trained. They may move to a larger area. And that work group is scheduled to present a report to the legislature in September of this year. So also in 2017, some preliminary market research was done to look at the need for senior assisted living and secure memory care in the larger Roseburg area. So a shift from looking at the need for skilled nursing care to assisted living and memory care in the Roseburg area. The research found that there is a need for about 180 to 200 assisted living beds and 80 to 85 secured memory care beds for veterans within a two-hour driving distance of Roseburg. And the study also noted that with the steady increase of the aging veteran population, it's expected that that need will obviously grow as well for those types of beds.
Could I make a comment? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Skilled nursing homes is the most expensive way to take care of our elderly. And the East Coast is very well known to have everyone goes into a nursing home. And we have been extremely successful in the state of Oregon in keeping our health care costs down by, having in-home services and just a number of different ways that we can care for our elderly. So I am concerned that we just focus on skilled nursing. Now, if there's a need, that's one thing. But I would hate to just proliferate skilled nursing services without taking into account other ways to serve this population.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, we absolutely agree. And, you know, as the study pointed out, and we know this, and Mary was also the state's long-term care ombudsman, and so is very familiar with this. Quite frankly, at this point, we are not recommending that we build another nursing home for Oregon veterans. It is not the model that Oregon uses now. Oregon's model is a leader in the country, and that is, least restrictive care, in-home care, those models. And so that's what we're looking at. And part of the remainder of the discussion is, that's what we would like to build, but the challenge that brings with it, because the federal VA hasn't quite caught up with that, that shift in the type of care we provide. But I'm gonna let Mary address that as well. She's much more qualified.
So for the record, Mary Yeager, Aging Veteran Services Director for ODVA. To Senator Manning's point earlier about how do we define aging, there is just as much controversy about the word home. So across veteran services in the United States, we often hear about the old veteran's home, right? The old soldier's home. In Oregon, to Sharon's point, we are 30 years into the Medicaid waiver and the use of assisted living, but that is a very, very new concept for the federal VA. And to follow up on her earlier point, the secondary study that was done addresses your point, Senator Montes-Anderson, that the need is really at the assisted living and memory care level. Even in our existing homes, we often say no to veterans and to their families and to their caregivers because they don't meet the criteria for skilled care. All the spouse knows is that they can't take care of their beloved veteran at home, but by Oregon standards, that very veteran would be qualified for assisted living, but yet does not meet the criteria to move into our existing homes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Manning, please.
Yes, I just have a question, well, two questions. One is that here in Oregon, ODVA, I mean, we're doing a lot of good things. I'm happy to hear that you're focusing on Roseburg. I've been speaking with Senator Wyden's office and a couple others about some things that have occurred in Roseburg. One, I recall a veteran went there for service, for help, and the staff said that they should keep him, retain him, and through some administrative work, they refused to keep him, and subsequently, he died. He had no place to go. So I'm glad to hear that there is some movement to set up something like that, specifically for those really pinpointed and perhaps not totally isolated, but incident that occur. Does the federal government offer any kind of matching funds to ODVA for programs like this? I don't know.
You want to take it?
Chair Boquist, Senator Manning, members of the committee, that is a really excellent question, and we have an entire slide on that because that is creating a challenge for us at this point. And so let's actually, because I think that's the next area. So, yes, the federal VA does matching funds for construction, but currently right now, and that's just with regards to construction, currently they only approve and fund matching funds for nursing care or domiciliaries. So for those of us in states who are shifting a model of care, whether it's California or some of the other states who are recognizing that a different model is more appropriate at this point the federal VA does not match construction dollars. There has been some discussion. And a lot of this discussion has been going on with Representative Evans, and who is the chair, you know, of our House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee. He has had conversations with the federal VA about the possibility of a waiver for the state of Oregon, and that waiver would be for the type of home that we could build. Excuse me. So if we were to request and receive a waiver, and at this point we don't know that we would actually get a waiver, but if we could get a waiver, it would be for those matching funds, that 65-35 split or maybe a different type of split. Additionally, the federal VA currently only provides per diem to our veterans living in our homes for those that live, again, in an assisted nurse, in a skilled nursing home. Right now, they do not provide per diem to veterans who live in an assisted living community. So you've actually hit the crux of where we are right now in this discussion.
Yeah, me too. We are bumping time here, Madam Director.
Okay, so that, quite frankly, that is that's where we're at. So we'll go to the very last slide. So where we feel that we are right now is we do need to be able to answer some questions. One, we need to have a better understanding of what it would cost the state to build an assisted living memory care facility in Roseburg, and that's a pretty easy question to have answered. We would need to take into account, obviously, the escalation costs for future building, and then we would need to have a better sense of whether or not the federal VA would either approve a waiver or if they are moving in that direction, because there has been some talk about the federal VA shifting the type of care that they will fund for construction and per diem. And then also, we would need to have a better understanding, could we staff, provide adequate staffing for a home in Roseburg, and that's part of that rural medical group discussion, but also noting that the staffing levels may not be the same as if we needed to staff a nursing facility. So that is it in a very, very quick.
Well, we're enthralled. I do appreciate your presentation. I think you've actually reached out to my office.
Yes.
I would like to have a further discussion on this right
here. Absolutely.
I appreciate, all of the input that we've gotten and the hard work that your new staff, new to you, has done. I welcome you to the agency. I will remind you of all of the major naval victories that we did in 3 years and 8 months in World War II. And we started down this surprise road, for those of us here in 2011, of a discussion of a Roseburg home. This is 2018.
Right.
I'm just pointing that out. I look forward to the opportunity to meet with you in my office.
Absolutely.
And make some suggestions along that line. But welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Thank you for updating us. And any other questions, colleagues? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, we have two items left on the agenda. Neither one are very long. I'm going to ask the legislative administration to come back to us in February. I don't know if there's anybody back there with legislative administration or not, to give them some more time on continuity planning, which only leaves us one topic that's on our agenda right now, which is state rail and barge catastrophic planning. And while the Fire Marshal, Department of Transportation, and Office of Emergency Management are all coming up, you will recall, colleagues, that we were asked to look into a series of issues involving railroads. Our normal mission for this committee is more catastrophic planning. We did, and Senator Manning was, because he was assigned to this mission late, and the committee late, was not aware and was unable to meet and come up to Mosier when we actually talked about site-specific issues in terms of events and rail along the Columbia River Basin. And what we're going to hear today, hopefully from our good colleagues in the executive branch, is sort of an idea of where we are at the state level in catastrophic plan. Not so much is there an oil train derailment or this deal or a barge sinking. It's what do, as for example, the Department of Transportation see they might have to do in a catastrophic event along the Columbia Basin, how long it might take, the functions they might do to make sure the rail works or the water works, and likewise across the board. And so we're really looking at the next tier up to get an idea of where the state is at. During the February session, we're going to ask some associations who couldn't come today to tell us what sort of capacity might be out in the private sector. And again, we're talking about capacity and capability and not details. So I'm going to let Hal, as the ranking member here, decide who's going to lead.
Senator Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Hal Gard. I am the administrator of the Rail and Public Transit Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I had a quick conversation with my colleague, Mr. Phelps, and he was going to kick it off, if that's all right.
Somebody has to kick off the football game.
Good morning, Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Monis Anderson. My name is Andrew Phelps, the Director of the Oregon Office of Emergency Management. I'd like to take this opportunity to provide a high-level overview of catastrophic response planning and frameworks here in the state of Oregon. We say in emergency management, all disasters begin and end at the local level. That's certainly true here in Oregon. We see it time and time again, regardless of the response. In fact, most emergencies don't even rise to the level of needing state resources or state coordination. Incidents happen throughout the state, border to border, that rely on local fire, law enforcement, EMS, and emergency management to respond initially to the incident, mitigate the impacts of the incident, and recover from those incidents. Only when the state is requested to fill gaps or bring additional resources to bear does my office generally get involved in the direct coordination of that emergency response. That said, we do try to maintain situational awareness statewide on what we call blue sky days so that we can better anticipate and be more forward-leaning should things quickly turn sideways, and we can be positioned to coordinate the resources of state agencies like the ones represented here at the dais today or the federal resources that can be brought to bear through our relationship with the Federal Emergency Management Agency. It's also important to note that FEMA is not necessarily the keeper of the keys when it comes to federal resources that can be brought to bear for response and recovery issues. The Oregon Health Authority, Department of Agriculture, Department of Transportation, and many other agencies here in the state of Oregon have direct relationships with federal agencies to bring specific subject matter experts or resources to the state for emergency and disaster planning and response. When we talk about the catastrophic, it's important to talk about mutual aid and the capacity that is brought to bear through the use of mutual aid agreements. We recently completed a revision and update to the interstate mutual aid agreement here in the state of Oregon. That's the ability to share resources among local jurisdictions, among state agencies, and even including the tribes should they sign up to be a part of the agreement statewide, regardless of the emergency, or for planned exercises or events like this past summer. Eclipse. That program, the Oregon Resource Coordination Assistance Agreement, has just completed the development of an implementation guide, and that's now a resource sharing agreement that's available statewide for any and all resources should an existing mutual aid agreement not be available to move those resources. We also have a couple of different mechanisms to move state-to-state resources. This past summer was historic for Oregon in a lot of ways on the emergency management front. It was the first time we used the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, or EMAC, to bring out-of-state resources into the state of Oregon for an emergency. The eclipse was actually the first time we'd ever used that compact to bring in out-of-state resources. Incidentally, it was also the first time that compact was used to support an eclipse response, which is fascinating to me and a footnote in a history book somewhere, I'm sure. It was also one of the largest mobilizations of in-state resources to move out of state. That happened twice in October in response to the Napa and Sonoma County wildfires, as well as this past December in response to the Thomas Fire in Santa Barbara County. We moved, and I'm sure the State Fire Marshal's Office can speak to this, hundreds of firefighters and firefighting apparatus down to California through the Emergency Management Assistance Compact to assist our neighbors to the south in their time of need. We also are members of PNEMA.
So with the Eagle Creek fire, we brought in a number of hot shots from around the nation. Was that involved in, was there a system set up where you reached out to all these different states to get them to come?
Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Monis Anderson, that's a slightly different coordination system through the National Wildland Coordination Center. They bring wildland firefighting specific resources throughout the state during wildfire season. We do have the capacity to bring structural firefighting resources to protect structures, which is a slightly different coordination system. But you're right, when we have catastrophic fires here in Oregon, whether they're burning in the wildland urban interface or in the more sparsely populated parts of our state, you do see firefighters from around the country coordinated by the U.S. Forest Service and the National Wildland Coordination Center that come in. And my office isn't directly involved in that coordination. Okay. It's more when we bring those structural firefighting resources in from out of state that my folks get involved in coordination with the State Fire Marshal's Office. The third mutual aid compact that I'd like to address is PNEMA, the Pacific Northwest Emergency Management Arrangement. This is a compact among the FEMA Region 10 states, which includes Idaho, Washington, Alaska, as well as Yukon and British Columbia in Canada. So it's an international resource sharing agreement, which is a little bit unique to our part of the country. We've demonstrated the capacity to move resources throughout the state on numerous occasions, and specifically with the Columbia River Gorge. Certainly the Mosier train derailment brought very specific resources from outside the region into the Columbia River Gorge for that incident. The ice storms in the winter of 2016 and 2017 brought a lot of resources into that area, and certainly the Eagle Creek fire that was just mentioned brought resources very quickly from around the state to protect those communities impacted by wildfires. So while I would rather say we don't have the opportunity to test these systems very often, the reality is we have far too many opportunities, I think, to move resources around the state to respond to our neighbors in time to need in their time of need. And I'm grateful that we've got the partners that we do that allow us to quickly move those resources around the state as quickly as we can. When we talk about capacity, there's sort of a continuum of capacity to respond and the time to respond. Through these mutual aid agreements and through our relationships with our federal partners, we have the capacity to bring Department of Defense resources into the state of Oregon, to bring resources from New York or Florida or California into Oregon. The question is time, how long it takes to move those resources here into the state. When we talk about Cascadia subduction zone earthquake and tsunami, time really becomes the most critical issue for us. We anticipate spending our initial response and our locally available resources, as limited as they may be, on saving and sustaining lives. It's only until we can bring in some of these secondary and tertiary resources from our federal partners and out-of-state partners that we can expand to our secondary and third priorities of saving property and protecting the environment. I'd like to close just by providing a brief update on the updates to the Cascadia Playbook, which is a planning initiative that my office has led in coordination with our state partners and federal partners and local and tribal partners as well. Following the Cascadia Rising exercise, we reframed how we're looking at that playbook. The current playbook as it stands is divided into 9 plays based on actions, obtaining situational awareness, life safety, mass care, and sheltering. We don't know that that's going to be the best model for us to allocate scarce resources during a catastrophic response. So we're redesigning that playbook to include all the same information, but to look at it through a lens of a time-specific response. What needs to happen in the first 4 hours, the first 12 hours, the first 24, 48, 72 hours, all the way up to the first 2 weeks? So we know we have benchmarks we want to meet from our catastrophic response priorities, and we can better ascertain what resources we have available and steer limited resources to meet those time-specific goals if we are concerned that they might not be met. So if we have a DOT resource and our priority is to open 2 routes to the coast within the first 72 hours, as an example, perhaps, and that's just an example to use, if we don't think we're going to be able to meet that deadline, we want to steer additional resources that might be working on lesser priorities to meet that one priority. We hope to have that playbook updated by the end of this year and continue to exercise the components of that playbook to ensure a safe, effective, and efficient response. So without any further comments on my part, I'll pause for questions or yield to the rest of the distinguished panel for their comments. Thank you.
That's you, Hal. Distinguished. You like
that? I'll try it on.
It's warmer here, too, I want to point out to you.
Okay? Real quickly, I'll follow up behind Mr. Phelps here, and just I think everybody here knows that my division doesn't have a clear statutory established a role in catastrophic response. However, we do play a support role within our own agency. Every one of my managers, including myself, carry around a thumb drive at all times that have got all key contacts and information for both public transportation providers and for the key railroads around the state. If our emergency operations center opens and our key staff are available to attend, we staff that center. We participate in exercises like the June 6, 2016 Cascadia Rising exercise, and we've worked very hard to include rail infrastructure information in the data laters that are used to support the work at our emergency operations center. Recognizing that rail has got a particularly unique ability to rebuild its infrastructure very, very fast, by moving work trains ahead of themselves or pushing Bailey Bridges out to replace a damaged structure. We've started a few discussions within our own rail advisory committee, one, to let the rail industry know what the size and scope and extent of that type of event can be, to let them know that we're, as a state, working on those concerns and just alerting them to the issue. Of course, the rail is private industry, and they are not compelled to become engaged. However, just kind of history around the nation, railroads have always been a willing player to step in and assist in emergency response. Just to kind of highlight, I don't really want to speak for our private partners, but I just want to highlight information that was provided to me from UP in response to the Harvey hurricane. In the that massive flooding that occurred during that event, UP reported that they had 1,750 miles of rail line that was out of service right after that event. Within 10 days, they had reestablished all 1,750 miles of service back in the Harvey area and were back in operations. So that capacity is something I think the state needs to be very aware of, particularly in a recovery mode. Of any event the size of Cascadia. So just to kind of remind the panel, we have four short lines that go to the coast. They're in varying states of repair or functionality. We have the Coos Bay Rail Link, which is up and running, although there's still infrastructure improvements that are needed. We have the Toledo line that ends at Toledo at a mill there. Again, it's up and functioning, although it can use some infrastructure improvements. Dollars are very tight, I think, as everybody here knows, for those short lines to maintain that infrastructure. There's the Tillamook Bay Railroad. It is, aside from a short segment that is doing excursion trains, not a functional short line on the coast. And then we have the A line, which is functional at the port westward, but is currently not running operations the last 30 miles out to the coast. So just kind of our readiness with regard to short lines to the coast is not ideal this time. Of course, we have our two Class 1 railroads, the BN Central Oregon line that is the standards of Class 1s, and, of course, UP's infrastructure that runs up and down the valley along the south shore of the Columbia River and up and over the Cascades through Oak Ridge. So those lines are in good shape. And with that, I can pause and take questions or turn it over to the fire marshal.
Let me just follow up with one. As Mr. Phelps pointed out, our federal colleagues might not be here for a while. And I think that later, from the February session, colleagues will find out more about capacity, maritime and rail capacity that's out there that might be helpful. So therefore, for quote, you know, I mean, your function is safety, and I think that there's capacity. Probably we're going to find out there's capacity for entities to fix the rail and fix the barges and things like that rather quickly. However, they're going to also look to government. The only functioning government at this point is going to be us, UHAL. Okay. And say, okay, are you going to give us approval to go up the line or go up the river or whatever in your capacity? In your mind, how long do you think, or have you thought about what your inspectors are have to go out and look at everything? And, of course, let's just be blunt. We go to Oak Ridge and over the top. That's one way into the Cascade area. We're coming up the gorge, one of the two. I mean, in your mind, are you thinking in hours or days or weeks before your people can out there? And it may, in fact, be exactly what we talked about in some of these events, walk the line.
Yes.
Because that may be your only mode of transportation.
Senator Boquist, members of the committee, just even thinking about at a Cascadia event is very hard to wrap your brain around. We are not going to know the extent of damage. We are not going to know folks impacted. We're not even going to know where our own people are to pull them in an immediate fashion to get them organized and pointed in the right direction. And as I think about it, we're going to be relying upon our private partners to deal with their own infrastructure, their own rail, to mass their own resources for repair. We will be suiting up and hitting the field as soon as we possibly can. In terms of timelines, it's speculation at best, but I would guess days, if not weeks.
You're on. Simple. You're just pinch hitting, right?
Good morning, Senator Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Hefner, Assistant Chief Deputy with the Oregon Office of State Fire Marshal. Wanted to take a brief opportunity to share the impacts of House Bill 3225 and the impacts have prepared Oregon for hazardous materials transport.
Very brief, because it's not our topic here.
Sure. Since enacting the House Bill 3225, nearly 10,000 hours of hazmat by rail-focused training and outreach has been delivered in Oregon. 8 firefighting foam trailers have been positioned regionally across Oregon. 2 railroad tank car props have been installed. 13 benzene-specific gas detection devices have been deployed with Oregon's regional hazmat teams, and 8 local hazmat by rail emergency response plans have been funded. In 2017, our office continued our partnership with the Oregon Fire Service Training Community, regional hazmat teams, and Union Pacific and BNSF Railroads, coordinating the delivery of both hazmat emergency response and incident command training courses. Funded by House Bill 3225, these courses have been offered free to local, state, federal, and tribal agency personnel. Numerous disciplines from all over Oregon and beyond attended these courses, from local firefighters and hazmat team members to city and county emergency managers to policymakers and to elected officials. Given this diverse group's attendance, they will collectively have a better understanding in preparing for and responding to hazmat by rail incidents as a unified front. Donated by Union Pacific and BNSF Railroads, the OSFM took delivery of 2 retired railroad tank cars in 2017. These tank cars were positioned on their sides to simulate a train derailment scenario at both the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training in Salem and the Eugene Springfield Fire Department Training Center. These training props have provided a hands-on tool for firefighters and hazmat responders to practice firefighting and spill release techniques. The OSFM is expected to receive additional retired tank cars in 2018 to be placed throughout Oregon. Also in 2017, the House bill funded the purchase of some detectors with benzene sensor capability for all 13 regional hazmat teams. These air monitors measure the existence of benzene gas, a crude oil byproduct, and other volatile organic compounds at the incident scene and in the affected community. Also in 2017, the House bill funded development of local hazmat by rail emergency response plans in 8 Oregon counties. These plans will have many elements, including modeling of possible toxic gas releases, evacuation routes, initial responder checklists, equipment cache locations, and many more. These plans are being developed with input from local, state, federal, and tribal agencies and integrating with existing plans to provide a more fluid and coordinated response. The OSFM is involved in planning and facilitation of hazmat by rail focused tabletops in 2017, both in Portland and Hood River. These are tabletops that use simulated response scenarios to test response plans, reveal operational gaps, identify training needs, and recommended updates to plans. In 2018, we plan to test the 8 hazmat by rail plans through additional tabletop exercises. And lastly, the OSFM is applying for grant funds to conduct a large-scale, full-scale exercise in spring 2019 that would involve local, state, federal, tribal, and railroad stakeholders and test the state coordination plan.
So let me ask you the same question that Hal got. How do you see the fire marshal integrating into a catastrophic event? I'm not talking about a derailment. I do greatly appreciate the information, and I greatly appreciate the fact that the fire marshal ODOT and ODOT primarily has taken an intense amount of time in planning with the private sector, and we're well ahead of what many people think we are, and your office has been integrated into that. But the real question we have here is, if the Cascadia happens or the electricity goes out, take your pick. I mean, nice thing is electricity is out and we just walk everywhere. How does the fire marshal, have you guys thought about, and I know you're integrated, the state police has planning, what functions are you going to have to do to open up corridors beyond highways? I mean, ODOT's got a very good plan of how to clear the highway, but it takes a whole lot of time. The question is, in the integration of rail and barge, how do you guys see how are you going to play in that environment? What things might need to be done, or is that not something you're going to need to do?
Senator Boquist, members of the committee, Director Phelps has already given a pretty good explanation of our fire service mobilization plan, and that is what the state fire marshal participates in and executes, is our state fire mobilization plan. Like Director Phelps said, when incidents all begin locally, and so when a local jurisdiction exceeds their capability with an incident and exhausts their countywide mutual aid, their fire defense board chief reaches out to the state fire marshal and requests resources that we are able, through our agency operations center in partnership with Oregon Emergency Management, to request resources from all over the state, ideally allocating resources in less impacted areas to areas that significantly are needing resources. So through our fire mobilization plan, we are able to tackle requests during a catastrophic event.
Questions, colleagues?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please.
Thank you. How do you interact with the Department of Energy Emergency Program on nuclear safety and chemical transportation through the state, such as if something happened? Do you interact with them, or do they contact you, or who is the lead on that?
I'm going to defer that to the Director Phelps. I forget who is the ESF for that.
Sure. Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, members of the committee. The Department, Oregon Department of Energy is the lead for nuclear planning and radiation monitoring. We also have partnerships with Oregon Health Authority. They were deployed several times following the tsunami debris disaster declaration to do sampling and monitoring of debris that was washing up. I can't speak to the specifics of monitoring cargo as it's being tracked through the state. I do know as a former firefighter, I was less concerned about the things I didn't know about and more concerned about less concerned about what I did know about and what was being reported, and more concerned about what I didn't know about things that were on UPS trucks and FedEx trucks. The fact of the matter is there's a lot of material being brought through the state. We rely on our state partners and our federal partners, Oregon Department of Energy, Oregon Health Authority here in state, and their relationships with the Department of Energy, the representatives they have that are in contact with the Hanford site, et cetera, to really be the key points of contact and the tip of the spear on those issues.
Thank you.
Mr. Phelps, to your knowledge, because what we're talking about is catastrophic planning here, and I get it, but I do know we're all familiar in this room, Senator Manning to a lesser extent, that as example, ODOT has identified, I believe, 352 bridges and counting that won't exist. So therefore, there isn't going to be any interoperability, mobility running around here, which at the catastrophic level, the question means, you know, we're going to wait. Several of us have attended the Cascadia events or training exercises you've had, so on and so forth. It will be self-help, as you've pointed out here. However, self-help might not, we're not going to be able to drive from the Capitol to, frankly, from the Capitol to the Anderson Readiness Center, because one of the bridges that covers is going to be out between here and there. So the governor's going to get to walk across the bridge and walk the last distance. So my question is in the self-help category, have we reached out to private sector that has heavy transport capability, like rail or barge, and said, what can you do? Would you like to participate in our Cascadia exercises? Has that invitation ever been made to the private sector that you know of?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, we've done a lot over the last several years to integrate the private sector through all phases of planning and really through all of our emergency support functions. In 2014, we realigned our emergency support functions to include a business and industry sector. That said, I think each of our emergency support functions, whether it's transportation, communication, mass care, public health, firefighting, they all recognize that the private sector has tremendous resources to bear. This is not going to be a government solution when we talk about a Cascadia response. We're going to need our heavy lift air partners that we have housed here in Oregon. We're going to need Caterpillar and the heavy equipment machinery folks. Our ESF2 folks, which is Department of Transportation, Mr. Gard is not the SME for that specific ESF, but our Public Works emergency support function is engaged with private sector to make sure that we can leverage, whether it's emergency contracting or standing contracts, to bring those resources to bear. You point out the deficiencies in communication, Chair Boquist. It's going to be a lot of Jim with his backhoe trying to move some debris to clear a road so that maybe an ambulance or a landing zone can be established to help those neighbors during the first 24, 48, or possibly 72 hours. It's going to require certainly innovative solutions to these complex problems. I would love to be able to say that we've solved all those problems today. We've solved more problems today than we had solved yesterday, and we're going to have more problems solved tomorrow. But it really is that ongoing dialogue, not just with our state partners, but our local emergency managers as well, getting them engaged in the conversations and making sure that we can leverage the same resources you see being leveraged, the private sector resources we see being leveraged to those large catastrophic disasters, whether it's the landslides currently going on in California, the hurricanes response in the Gulf Coast area, or anywhere else in the country where we see folks having a bad day.
I just want you to know that in the transportation, communication, and fuel plan, communications were actually going to be bad. Verizon and AT&T were invited. After the fuel plan came out, this is not your agency, I got that. But then after this committee was asked to go back and look at heavy transport, I have personally, and members of this committee and members of the staff, have been at the events and personally asked the maritime folks and the rail folks, both short, long, heavy, Hal knows the definition, whatever it is, had they ever been invited to a Cascadia event or a planning exercise? And the answer is no, across the board, not one of them. Not one of the major fuel companies, not one of their major answers, no. Now, if the people we're asking are the wrong people, then we're asking the wrong people. And I don't need an answer right now. But the bottom line here is the self-help is us. And us is in the state of Oregon, and it's not just the government. We have talked a good story since 2005, and Senator Verger and I co-chaired this committee in a joint committee. But where we're sitting at right now is that when we, the members, reach out to private sector and say, okay, you're the vice president of, you know, Lewiston Barge Company, have you ever been invited to come participate or ask the question, we're getting a resounding no. When I reach out to pick the petroleum company, we get a resounding no. We distributed the plan out to the private sector and said, have you guys ever seen this? And it's a resounding no. Our self-help is broke, period, end of subject. And the two key pieces, which are power, transportation, and communications, ODOT is miles ahead of everybody else. The state police and stuff are miles ahead of everybody, but we need the private sector to get involved. And they're not getting, I mean, we learned at Mosier, just so you know, for those who weren't here, that if you take two-thirds of the slice of Oregon, the agencies in the private sector, they're on a first-name basis. They unfortunately sit around these tables doing war games, command sergeant major, all the time. There's 2,000, some of them, as you pointed out, trained. And so two-thirds of the state's on the bandwagon with the private sector, and the other one-third isn't on the bandwagon. And we're going to fix that very, very shortly. And so I would encourage, we have a Cascadia planning table, June, am I right? August, when's the next big Cascadia planning event?
Chair Boquist, the next big exercise that we see, similar to the 2016 exercise, isn't going to be until probably 2020 or 2021. But we do have quarterly exercises where we evaluate our ECC response for a variety of hazards.
I would suggest you start sending invitations out. And I expect to see copies of them, or expect to be back here in less than pleasant circumstances. Hal, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I'm sorry I missed your name.
Michael Heppner.
Michael, thank you. Thanks. I'm sorry to be blunt. I know you have a thankless job where you get to browbeat everyone and ask them. We've been there. All the agencies are out there, and the chairs are empty, and you've sent the invitation. I get it. But we do need to be doing a better job of this, because there are other events that could transpire that lead up to this. And so we as a team, including the legislature, I'm more willing to roll up the sleeves and go out and invite people too, just need to do a better job of it. Colleagues?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Appreciate
thank you. And I did is I put off legislative administration to give them not more time, but because we're running out of time and members, I apologize, we're 12 minutes over what you thought we were gonna be here. Anything for the good of the order? If not, I guess we'll see each other hopefully in February, unless it's in some special session because a catastrophic event happened. Thank you very much, colleague.